You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. We talk about music every month with internationally renowned cellist Robert Cohen. It's a segment we call On That Note, and it examines the life of a professional classical musician. This month, it's all about choosing the most important tool of his trade. Robert, great to see you. How have you been?
Very well, thanks. Great to see you too.
I have maybe a rather personal question for you this month.
Fire away.
Instruments are so important to the people who play them, and particularly people like you who make a living with the instrument that you play. How do you go about choosing an instrument, and what are you looking for?
Well, I think all musicians have a kind of dream that they're going to play a really wonderful instrument, and it's going to make them sound incredible. And so from a quite early age, I suppose, you start thinking about it. And if you're doing well, if you're playing well, probably your teacher will say to you something like, you need a better instrument than this. You need something that allows you more potential with the sound. And from there, it's a major battle because the better the instrument, the more ridiculous the price. The way I did it, for instance, was I just started looking for something that sounded really nice that was going to be what seemed a huge amount of money, so several thousand pounds, and then borrowed some money to buy that, and then after a couple of years, tried to kind of move on. Now, all instruments that are nice appreciate in value because they're works of art, and that's the one complicated part about it, because the instruments that are really amazing appreciate even faster than the ones that are not. So you're on this ladder which you're, you know, chasing the better instruments, and so you have to move quickly. You have to buy another instrument, and then you have to move on. And I just found myself in huge debt.
I was going to say, because musicians are not known for making a lot of money unless you are a pop star.
That's right. But so you fall in love. It's really, really dangerous. You play this instrument and suddenly you think, oh my goodness, I can express myself in ways I never dreamt about before. And so you just literally, it's kind of love at first sight. Well, it's like that with me anyway. And so I would walk into a dealer, an instrument dealer or an auction house and play something and just suddenly feel, oh, this is my future, this is my voice, you know. And my instincts are very strong, so I tend to really fall very quickly for something that I feel is going to fulfill my kind of sound world. And it's a very difficult thing then. Of course, you've got to raise the money. I'll tell you a story about how I, once I'd got going with really, really fine instruments, and then I finally came to the point where I saw a Stradivarius cello for sale at Sotheby's auctions. And it was, you know, very rare that this ever happens. Stradivari cellos rarely come up on the market, and they're usually snapped up by collectors or individuals who are hugely wealthy, who just feel like something unique. Rarely do the musicians get a chance, but this instrument went on sale and I went to see it and thought this was an amazing instrument, which you would expect in a way, but not all Stradivarius cellos are amazing. And I thought, well, I will try to buy it, which meant a lot of kind of heartache, really, because first of all, I was told that as a known musician, it was really bad for me to go into the auction house. In a way, when you're a known musician, you kind of set the value of an instrument. If you think it's worth $1 million, then it is worth $1 million.
So you could end up driving up the price without trying to.
That's
just
exactly.
By being there. Okay.
So I was told, don't be there. Get somebody else who knows how to do the bidding and all that to do it for you. So I actually found somebody, an art consultant who was really experienced in buying Picassos and huge, you know, mansions and things like that at auction. And I got them to do the bidding for me. The auction house usually knows who's going to be there, who's going to be bidding, which dealers are interested and so on. And my guy comes in right before lot number 64, the Stradivarius cello, and stands at the back of this huge hall. Now, what happens at an auction when a Strad cello goes on sale is that the TV are there, radio are there, everybody's really fascinated. So he just comes in a very subtle way and waits until the bidding just starts to slow down. And at that point, puts his hand up, and apparently the whole place kind of froze because they thought somebody who's going to start bidding at that price, who we don't know, it's going to be trouble. And so I think one other person put the bid in against him, and he immediately came back at that. And then they just, it stopped and the hammer went down.
And I won the cello.
And wow. It was really, really extraordinary. So was then, of course, I had a massive bank loan, which I then spent only the 10 years trying to cope with. But I had this incredible cello. And
it was worth it?
It was worth it. But then, by chance, my father gave me a call and said, do you know what? There's a cello on Sotheby's, which you might be really interested just to look at, because it's made by a maker from Rome of the same period as Stradivari, who's not nearly as famous, called David Techler. And he made some incredible cellos. And we thought, well, let's just go along and have a look at this cello. So we went to Sotheby's and I played this cello, and the same thing happened again.
You fell in love again.
Completely fell in love. And it was really, really difficult because I thought, well, this can't be right. You know, when you have a Stradivarius cello, there is nothing greater than that. But then I discovered that it's not just about, you know, how great the instrument is. It's really how well it suits you. And obviously the Strad, I had really loved it. The strange thing about Stradivari instruments is the personality is so strong that it's like when you're on the platform, you're actually, you have another person with you. It's not like you're playing the cello. It's like there's this man wagging his finger at you saying, no, not like that. You have to play like this, and it has to be just perfect, and it has to be exactly the way I want it. And then you will get amazing sound. And I realized when I played this Techler cello that this cello wasn't doing that to me. It wasn't wagging a finger, but it was allowing me to make really, really beautiful sound. And I suddenly felt free. The last 10 years, I've been doing what I've been told to do with great results, but now is the moment to feel really as though anything I wanted to say, I was going to say it.
Well, and I would think that that is something that changes over your career because, of course, as a musician, you change. So what was right 10 years ago may not be right now, even though it's a phenomenal instrument.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, and also the more you explore what you feel you want to communicate, the more you expand your ideas, and then your ideas about what the instrument can do can change. And you can get frustrated in some ways, and you can discover things that you hadn't looked for before. So the instrument is really very, very personal. It is your voice. And therefore, of course, you have to look after it amazingly well. And you have to have it, we call, set up the way it will react to you the way you need it to be. One person likes to approach an instrument in a very different sort of way physically than another player. And so the instrument needs small adjustments to cope with those differences.
And so that could be everything from how high the bridge is for the strings to the type of strings that you use. And I imagine that there's other things that happen between you and the technician that you work with.
Yes, and the luthier who works on your instrument for you and adjusts it and sets it up for you, just like you said, with a different type of bridges, with sound posts, which is the kind of thing inside the instrument, that person has to understand what you're trying to do. When you put the bow on the string, they have to have an instinct as to why it is you're doing it that way and what you're looking for. And in my entire life, I've only come across three people who I can trust to think and feel the way I do about the sound. And it's not words. Sometimes I just play the instrument to them and we look at each other and then they take it from me and they make adjustments and then they give it back to me minutes later or seconds later. And we don't even speak, and then I play it again. And then they can tell by the way I'm working on the instrument, whether I'm working too hard, whether I'm pushing to find a more brilliant sound or a more mellow sound, and it's not happening. They'll just take the instrument away from me again, make another small adjustment and give it back to me. And it's this kind of process, which if you don't have such a strong connection with this luthier, then it just doesn't work. In fact, it's a most terrible feeling when somebody makes even the tiniest adjustments. It's like they're operating on you.
And it's wrong.
And it's so painful.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's a relationship that you have to have with this person. Like you said, it's almost like they have to be in your head and in your fingers to kind of get what it is that you're trying to do. And they have to have the technical skill to be able to realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a lot of magic in this, because I think the greatest luthiers don't really – they'll not say – this is how it has to be. If you want this sound, we have to do this. The greatest ones will never have the answer. They'll always go by feel. They'll sense their way around the instrument, because every instrument is individual. There are no two the same. And so there can't be a strict method for creating certain results. They have to feel the instrument just the way you do, and to sense its limitations and its qualities, and they have to get excited by the same things you do. That's so important. Actually, the person that I have used for many years now, who is a Finnish man, he works in Helsinki, and we got to know each other actually because he came to lots of festivals that I was playing at in Finland, and he was just listening to the concerts and I was playing, and then we're listening to other people playing, and we would chat, and the chats would get longer and longer and longer. And he hadn't touched my cello at that stage. I started to realize that this man really is thinking the way I'm thinking. And then finally, I thought, well, my cello needs a little bit of work. Every now and again, a cello needs some kind of either adjustment or things need to be replaced because they wear. Anyway, he did this and it sounded really great. And ever since then, we've worked on things together slowly and carefully over the years. Now, I sound a bit kind of totally fanatical and obsessive about this. But once you have, particularly once you have an incredible instrument, it becomes super sensitive to any slight adjustment or things that are not quite right. And you know, you have amazingly high expectations of an instrument that can sound so amazing, but it has to work, as I say, for you.
This is a huge topic, and next time I want to talk about something we haven't even touched on yet, which is bows, because that's the other part of the instrument. But we don't have time for that this month, so that's going to have to be next month. Robert, as always, such a pleasure, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen is an award-winning recording artist, conductor, artistic director, and cellist for the Fine Arts Quartet. He spoke with us as part of our regular monthly segment called On That Note with Robert Cohen. And that is all the time we have for this edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. All the latest news from around the world comes your way at noon with Here and Now from WBUR in Boston and NPR. But stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.